I'm your host, Webster Tarpley, speaking from Washington, D.C. We're taping this afternoon, Friday, the 24th of October, in the middle of another panic crash of world markets. Everything is down 7, 8, 9, 10% around the world, and we've got countries lining up to go to the IMF, to grovel, to submit to limited sovereignty and IMF conditionality. This is the true engine of the finance oligarchs as they attempt to seize power over the world. The new currency dictator of the planet is Dominique Strauss-Kahn, former finance minister of France. If you're living in Belarus, Pakistan, Serbia, Hungary, Turkey, or Ukraine, your country is now being submitted to IMF limited sovereignty and crushing conditionality, all according to the Washington Consensus, which, of course, is the lunatic free market, free trade, wild capitalism of Milton Friedman and Alan Greenspan and von Hayek that has led to the current crisis. But we've got to look ahead now to the political appointment coming up on us fast in about 10 to 12 days, depending on when you hear this. And that is, of course, the election. I want to call everybody's attention, most of all, to the remarks of Senator Joe Biden in Seattle on the morning of the 19th of October, where he, in effect, blurted out in his characteristic way the scenario for the Obama regime. And let me point, above all, to two scenarios. You've got to imagine him talking in a fundraiser. He's giving the inside story to people so that they'll feel like they're really on the inside and that they'll give more money to the Obama machine. You can imagine Bill Gates sitting there, Belinda Gates, Jeffrey Balmer, the guy who currently dominates Microsoft, these other characters from the Microsoft empire and others. Maybe Gordon Getty flew up from San Francisco. We don't know. So two separate fundraisers. He rakes in more than $1 million, and he tells them the following story. He gives them two perspectives. One is a 12-month perspective, and he says, I guarantee you within 1 year, you will be sitting here saying, why are we so far down in the polls? Why is everything so bad? And Biden says, in effect, that the entire Obama regime will collapse out of tremendous unpopularity. It will be hated. The poll ratings will collapse. All of the Kool-Aid drinkers, cultists, zombies, and left liberals will be betrayed. Obama will be attacking his own base. He'll be betraying his own base. And they'll be saying, whoa, wait a minute. I don't know about these policies that you're enacting now. But, says Biden, you can count on us to make decisions that are sound, because if they're popular, they won't be sound. So what he's talking about is what I have talked about now for many months, crushing austerity. Killer austerity, genocidal sacrifice for the American people. Get set to see things like rickets and pellagra in the inner cities and on the high plains and in the southern mountains. Get ready to see Americans reduced to rags under an Obama regime, while Soros, Rockefeller, and Goldman Sachs get everything they want. Don't put a banker's boy in the White House, Biden is reminding us, or this is what you're going to get. And, of course, this will be done under left cover. We'll have left cover strike breaking. We'll have sacrifices and austerity, tremendous downward pressure on the standard of living in the name of the polar bears, in the name of global warming, in the name of alternative energies, in the name of third world development and solidarity with the peoples of Africa, who won't see a penny because the money is all going into the pockets of George Soros, David Rockefeller, and the boys at Goldman Sachs. So that's the 12-month. That compares pretty much with Jimmy Carter. If you look at my book, Obama the Postmodern Coup, you will see that I speculate there. If you compare Obama to Carter, that other catastrophic trilateral puppet 3 decades ago, Carter collapsed within 12 months. He had lost 25% from his peak. He peaked just after the 100 days, so in the spring, say about April. And then by 12 months after that, actually 12 months after the inauguration, he had lost 25%, and he never recovered from that. So he had the majority of the population against him. So that is the kind of savage, brutal, crushing economic policy, unpopular in the extreme, probably tending towards civil war, that Obama will give you in the first 12 months. And I'm not telling you this. This is what Biden has told you now, confirming in the most blatant way the thesis of my books, Obama the Postmodern Coup and Barack H. Obama the Unauthorized Biography. Now, that's already very bad. Remember, economic austerity kills more people than war, except for thermonuclear war. So let's see if that's what we've got. We may be looking at that. He then tells us the six-month perspective. Biden says to this group of fat cats in Seattle, Washington, it will not be 6 months before the world tests Barack Obama like they did John Kennedy. Watch. We're going to have an international crisis, a generated crisis to test the mettle of this guy. It could be a scenario from the Middle East. It could be a scenario from Russia. And it's not going to be initially apparent that we are right. So a generated crisis in the first 6 months, probably involving Russia, that would be the novelty. That would be the big news. And that's the overwhelming tendency of the foreign policy elite of the United States. The U.S. position is not immediately righteous, or its righteousness is not immediately apparent. What could this be? Well, the one obvious thing is a false flag. We know Andrew Sullivan, writing in the Atlantic Monthly, you can find the quotes on this in Obama, the Postmodern Coup, The Making of a Manchurian Candidate, available from Amazon.com, along with the biography. Andrew Sullivan complained in the Atlantic Monthly last December that the U.S. imperialist ruling class is suffering from a handicap. They cannot have recourse to a false flag operation because the figure sitting in the White House, the tenant of the White House, as we've always called him, is so hated and so discredited that if Bush came out and said, there's been a bomb and country X did it, people would not believe him. There would be rage against him. He would not command majority support. A large, large group would say, this is because of your bungling stupidity. A very significant minority would say, you did this, you staged this, this is an inside job, this is just another 9/11, a provocation, and we're not going along with it. So Andrew Sullivan complained, how can we run an imperialism under these conditions? We've got to give imperialism a facelift. So with Bush, the possibility of credibility in case of a false flag attack is zero. McCain, it's probably 10 to 20%. With Barack Obama, you get up to the 40, 50, 60% range, depending on how it's done, where this becomes another possibility. So if you want to keep the door of false flags shut, keep Obama out of the White House at all costs, because as he comes in with his seraphic messiah personality, his messianic rhetoric, and his utopian platitudes, he will essentially be reopening the door to false flag slaughter. What will it be? Oh, in Vermont a couple of weeks ago, we had people being told that there was going to be a bird flu epidemic. Watch out for biological warfare. Watch out for nuclear. It's going to have to represent a significant escalation compared to 9/11. It's probably not going to be conventional. It's probably going to get us back to those fabled WMDs, the weapons of mass destruction. The other thing it could involve is an obvious aggression by a U.S. puppet state. Take the case of Georgia. Using the mighty Wurlitzer as much as they could, the foreign policy elites were able to create the idea for at least some people that Russia had been aggressor against Georgia. We know that the tin pot Mussolini named Saakashvili, puppet of Soros and Brzezinski, was the aggressor, killed a lot of Russians, deserved even more than what he got in return in the form of proportional retaliation, if that's the new slogan. But that kind of thing where the U.S. is backing an aggressor, say backing Poland and Ukraine against Russia in something really ugly, like an attempt to kick the Russian fleet out of their ports in the Black Sea, that's the kind of thing. We'll be back in just a minute here on World Crisis Radio.
Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. To sum up the argument, I've been arguing since January. Obama brings two things. International confrontation of the most dangerous kind. Forget about basically defenseless states like Iran. Let's look at Russia. Let's look at China, places that can and will defend themselves. He's courting confrontation with them, albeit through proxies, through puppet states, through kamikaze puppets. That's the one side. That's the generated crisis in the first 6 months that Biden, in his infamous Seattle blurt out, is warning us against. The other side, of course, Biden says it's going to be a systemic crisis. And as Cramer on CNBC has been saying, they want more and more bailouts. They want new tranches of up to $1 trillion each. And they want to start looting the Social Security Trust Fund with $100 billion for starters and put that money into what? Into toxic derivatives that nobody else will buy. The bailout of the $1 quadrillion derivatives bubble at your expense has begun, and the blood and bones of the American people are going to be fed into the meat grinder of the Wall Street derivative machine. And if you have a one-party state under the repo clique, that is to say Reid, Pelosi, Obama, the repo clique will do the bidding of Soros, Rockefeller, Goldman Sachs, and there will be no place to hide. There will be the most ferocious austerity that we've seen since the Third Reich, and you don't want to be around for it. So let's not find out about it. Let us mobilize now. We'll be back to the issues of the election in just a minute. Obviously, the lesson from this is if you vote for Obama, you're going to get a generated crisis in the first 6 months, and then in the first 12 months, you're going to have economic austerity, a nightmare that you can hardly dream of. But we've got a very important guest on the line. It's Kevin Barrett out there in Wisconsin. Kevin, as you know, stalwart of the 9/11 Truth Movement, fighter for academic freedom, fighter for democracy in all of its forms, running for Congress a little bit west of Madison, Wisconsin, as I understand it. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you, Webster. It's great to be with you.
Please give us, in the time that you have available, I know you've got to run off to one of your events, but please give us a summary of your campaign, where you stand, and how people can help you and join in.
Well, we're trying to make a lot of noise about this banker bailout, because people are really fed up with that. You know, I'm in a rural conservative district. It's not the easiest place to sell 9/11 truth. Although we did conduct a poll that showed that 22% of people in two-voter households where somebody has voted in a recent election, and these, of course, are the most plugged into the system households in the district, say that 9/11 might have been an inside job. So that's not too bad. But we've also done a poll showing that 79% say bail out the people, not the bankers. Ron Kind, the incumbent, my enemy of choice, who voted for the banker bailout bill, admitted that 50% of his calls were saying no, and 50% were saying hell no. So there's universal opposition pretty much to the bailout. And this, I think, leads us to the key issue in the coming years, which is the struggle against this financier dictatorship that's taking shape.
Absolutely. And, well, that would be that's going to be the big issue as we go forward. And how do you see this?
Well, you know, I think we have to educate people at the grassroots level. And, you know, 9/11 was tough for educating people out in the hinterlands. You know, rural people tend to be smart. They're smart. They're grounded. But there's a kind of innate patriotism that makes it really hard for them to accept the fact that their own top leaders have murdered thousands of their own people in a false flag attack like 9/11. So that's a tough, slow educational job. But the idea that these big international financiers are picking their pockets, well, I mean, they've known that forever. So it's not as tough to bring people on board with this anti-bailout issue, which leads us towards all the other issues related to the struggle against the financier dictatorship, such as end the Fed, which I think should be a big slogan that should be on everyone's lips.
Nationalize the Fed is the version we have here, because you want to use that for the American people. Rip it out of the hands of that clique of bankers and use it to create credit for production only, not for financier swindles. Look, Chrysler this morning announced they're going to cut their white-collar workforce by 25%. I would think that would reach, if not into your district, then pretty close. And of course, that's Cerberus hedge fund doing that. Hedge funds, of course, should be outlawed. And one of the people involved in this is that guy Jon Snow, who appeared yesterday with Greenspan at the Waxman Committee defending the legalization of derivatives by this crew. But tell us a little bit about your campaign on the ground and, above all, your website and how people can help.
Okay, well, let's start with your second question first. The website is barrettforcongress.us. That's Barrett, B-A-R-R-E-T-T, and spelled out F-O-R, congress.us. People can go there, and if you want to volunteer to make phone calls, let's say you've got free long distance, if you want to call the people who said they think that 9/11 might have been an inside job and tell those people to vote for me and send me money, you're welcome to volunteer. Just email me through that website, barrettforcongress.us. As far as the campaign on the ground goes, I've been making a lot of visits to La Crosse, actually, a few to Eau Claire. Those are the only two real cities in the district of any size. And in La Crosse, I've been hounding Ron Kind, the incumbent who voted for the war, for all the Shred the Constitution measures, and, of course, for these bailout bills. So I've been dogging him. I went to his office recently in a V for Vendetta mask, asking when is he going to fulfill his promise to debate me. He stupidly blurted out that he would be happy to debate me last spring, and he's been dodging that ever since. I will be seeing him in person, though, I believe, on Tuesday at a campaign forum at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. And if he hasn't set up a face-to-face debate with me by then, he's going to get an earful.
Maybe you could ask him, what are these economic measures that Obama and Biden are planning, which are going to be so unpopular that within 12 months the poll ratings of that regime will fall to lows, I think apparently lower than Bush, as Biden said in Seattle this past weekend?
That's a very good question. Asking Ron Kind that question, though, is probably not going to get you a straight answer, because Ron Kind actually makes Barack Obama look like an honest, hard-hitting kind of guy who addresses all the details of his policies. In other words, this guy, Ron Kind, is even more of an impressionistic candidate than Obama is. You know, Obama sells this message of hope, this vague message that's detached from all of his policies and the real place in the power structure that he occupies. And Ron Kind is very similar. He basically purveys his name, Mr. Kind, and gives the impression of being a kind guy. He's good looking. He has a Barbie doll wife, and he talks real sweet and real vague. And so asking him anything with any actual empirical content is utterly hopeless.
Well, I wonder then, how does he justify voting for the bailout when he's telling us that almost 100% of his constituents who expressed opinions were against it?
Well, it's the usual vague, we have to save the economy line.
Can you come back for a couple of more minutes?
Yeah, sure. I'll be
back. Okay. We'll be back in a second on World Crisis Radio.
For listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. We're up to here in Washington, D.C., and we're talking to Kevin Barrett, Libertarian candidate for Congress in Wisconsin, the district around Eau Claire and La Crosse. His website, Barrett for Congress, B-A-R-R-E-T-T, for Congress.com. Go there and give him the contribution. He's so shy, but that's what you need to do, and volunteer.
Yeah, that's BarrettForCongress.us.
Sorry, U.S.
Okay.
Now, maybe some other issues, right? We've got the bailout. We've got 9/11 truth. A couple of others. I know you have an interesting position on health care.
Yeah, I try to tie all of my biggest issues together because I think they're all closely related. War and peace is tied into 9/11, of course, because 9/11 doubled the military budget and launched these wars of aggression. The banker bailout is part of this larger picture of this dictatorship of the financiers who are behind the military adventures and plundering the rest of us. And I decided to become a probably the only libertarian in the country in favor of single-payer health care as a way, not just because it's the right position, which it is, but also to sort of make a statement and say, you know, look, the Libertarian Party has to become a lot more pragmatic and more realistic. This utopian idea that you can just abolish the entire government and then what will emerge is a free and fair market, I think is a bit naive. And here's an issue that looks like it's way off on the left side of the spectrum, right? Only the far left wants single-payer health care. But, hey, the rest of the industrial world uses it. Every other advanced industrialized country has either national health care or single-payer. And so we're lagging behind here. Our country is spending twice as much on health care, more or less, as these other countries. We're getting worse results. If you're paying twice as much for something and getting a worse product, then you should shop around. And if you shop around the world and look at health care around the world, it's obvious that some form of universal health care is the way to go. So I decided to, you know, to ride that horse. And, of course, it immediately got me a Libertarian challenger in the primary who made that his main issue. And miraculously, I won the Libertarian primary in a landslide, 60-40, with the single payer being the big issue. So that discouraged some of the more extremist libertarians. But I think it shows that the Libertarian Party could move to the center and really grow, because it's perceived right now as being to the right of the Republicans on the economic issues. And that's not going to work in an environment of economic collapse. When the economy gets bad, people do look to the government to do something to right the situation. And so this all ties in with my argument that we need to retool the economy for the benefit of the ordinary people and not this financier elite.
I think you're very much to be commended on that. The obvious points that the libertarians have going is freedom from war, freedom from police state oppression, but it's not freedom from government health care. It's freedom to have it if that's the alternative that presents itself. So I think that's important. And the entire ideological complex around this extreme free market, free trade, wild capitalism, unregulated savagery of the unrestrained markets, that is going to become just the kiss of death, as you say, right? It's going to be completely untenable when we get into the winter of this year and the chain reaction layoffs keep going. People are going to be looking around for concrete assistance, not ideology, but real help.
Well, that's right. And we need to get people focused on reality and on defending their own interests and the interests of other ordinary people in the real empirical world, rather than having people living in some kind of fantasy world where the heroic Christian Americans are off defending Western civilization against the evil, dark-skinned Muslims, and that's what people are all excited about. That kind of detachment from reality is extremely unhealthy in a democracy, and so I do hope to help move the political discourse back towards issues of on-the-ground reality.
Rugged individualism, after all, was the slogan of Herbert Hoover in 1932, right? Don't worry about the world economic depression. Don't worry about the collapse of the world monetary system, but tough it out as a rugged individualist. And that there would have been no end to that, and there would have been nobody left surviving. So, again, it's BarrettForCongressUS.com.
No, BarrettForCongress.us.
Okay, fine. You got it. And obviously you want to give a contribution, volunteer your time, do some phone calls. And, any parting remarks?
Yeah, I think everybody should consider running for Congress. If you're smart enough to appreciate Webster Tarpley's radio show, you're probably Congress material. In fact, you're probably a notch above the average Congress critter. So think about running. It's not that hard. I only needed 1,000 signatures to get on the ballot. If I can do it, I'm sure some of you can, too.
And that's right. And you are really to be commended about that, too, because you right now you're the I think you're one of the two candidates with the 9/11 Truth Inspiration that are left standing. We could have had much more if we hadn't had, a massive ingress of naysayers and sectarians and others. Anyway, let's leave them in the dust where they belong. Congratulations to Kevin Barrett. If you're in La Crosse or Eau Claire and that congressional district in Wisconsin, what number is the district again?
It's Wisconsin's third district.
The third of Wisconsin. Okay, so if you're in Wisconsin 3, Your man is Kevin Barrett for Congress, and I urge you not just to vote. One little vote is nice, but the things that count, obviously, are activism, volunteering, money, and all the other things. Write an article, send a letter to a newspaper, and so forth. Thank you, Kevin, and we hope you come back next week. We want to have a general election roundup with all of the people that are still fighting, still in the field, and you have a place of honor among them.
Sounds good, Webster. Talk to you same time, same channel next week.
We'll see you next week at the same time.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye. Now, we're told that one of the reasons for the tremendous turbulence in the market is that a major hedge fund has blown. And that, of course, is coherent with the pattern that we've been seeing. Right now, there's about $2 trillion, we're told. These are estimates, of course, because nobody knows how much money is invested in hedge funds because they don't have to tell you. They're completely deregulated. They are the spawn of wild capitalism of Milton Friedman, von Hayek, Greenspan, and the other mad architects of this crisis. So we don't know, but we figure that hedge funds are about $2 trillion. Those are the big bucks of the really wealthy parasites, and it's estimated that at least a quarter of them, this is an official estimate from some news agency, one quarter of those hedge funds are going to blow. They're going to be gone by the end of next year. I think that's a very, very conservative estimate. I think most hedge funds have even less time to go. And, of course, the redemptions coming out of hedge funds have been huge. And this is one of the main reasons why the price of oil has been going down, because it's hedge fund speculation, along with Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and J.P. Morgan Chase speculation. But hedge fund speculation has been a huge factor in pumping up the price of oil and gouging you at the pump. So as the hedge funds approach bankruptcy, the price of oil goes down, down, down. It's now into the mid to upper 60s, $67 a barrel, I think, last time I looked. Imagine if we could just outlaw hedge funds and wipe out all of their speculation. It would probably go down to about 40. So that is the choice. If you listen to this nonsense about free markets and deregulation, then you're going to have hedge funds. You're going to have derivatives. They're going to skin you alive and flay you alive. Then Obama and Pelosi and Reid, with the help of Goldman Sachs, will come along and tell you that it's time to bail them out, and then you're going to be flayed alive another time. The only way out of this is to put aside the absurd and obsolete slave ideology and sucker ideology of free market and free trade and all the rest of this stuff. People have understood the part about free trade being a fraud. Everybody would like now to get away from free trade. But the other side of the coin is so-called free market. That's the ultimate citadel of reactionary ideology. So what you're seeing is the result. We'll be back in a minute. Here in Washington, D.C., and we are in the midst of the maelstrom economically, financially, and politically coming up to the election. Now, as I repeated already in the first segment, starting on January 7th of this year with essays and very soon with a book, Obama the Postmodern Coup, which was issued in April, well in advance of the Pennsylvania Democratic primary, and then following that up in September with Barack H. Obama, the unauthorized biography. These volumes available from Amazon.com. I argued that the Obama regime would mean two things: crushing, brutal domestic sacrifice and austerity, a tremendous downward pressure on the U.S. standard of living, cutting it by one-fourth, one-third, by one-half, depending on political conditions. and at the same time an attempt to mount a confrontation against Russia, China, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, viewing an attempt to break up Pakistan as an included feature, an attempt to kick the Chinese out of Africa to deny them the oil of Sudan, the minerals and raw materials of Zimbabwe and similar countries, that Africa would become a battlefield between the Anglo-Americans and the Chinese, the ultimate goal being to drive the Chinese out of that continent, force the Chinese to give up their sources of oil and raw materials, and ultimately to drive the Chinese in on eastern Siberia, to tell them to go and get their oil and minerals across the border, where there are a few Russians, many minerals, and even many Chinese at this point. So an attempt to set up World War III between Russia and China in accordance with the Brzezinski Doctrine and the Brzezinski Plan, which is the operative thing that Biden is referring to here, and that this would be made possible by the facelift to imperialism made possible by the demagogic rhetoric of Obama and the immense investment of hundreds of billions of dollars in worldwide propaganda in building up the empty suit Obama as the Messiah and the Mahdi and the anointed one and the perfect master and all the rest of it, so that it would be essentially a fascist, social fascist, or neo-fascist policy. All of this is now confirmed by Biden. So Biden essentially endorses the conclusions of Obama the postmodern coup and Barack H. Obama the unauthorized biography. I urge you to get those books. If you want to know what you're going to get, go to Amazon.com, buy those books. But in the meantime, now that Biden has done you the courtesy of informing you what you're going to get under an Obama regime, you've got to decide that you're going to stop Obama at all costs. You're going to have to vote for anybody in sight that will allow you to defeat Obama. And how you do that depends on the state where you live, depends on who you are, depends on how much you can manage. There are other candidates, needless to say, and there are all sorts of other candidates. You can see who's on the ballot where you are. Again, the main thing is to stop Obama, because under any other regime, it will be much harder to organize these kinds of confrontations. There will be, with McCain, no facelift for imperialism. There will not be 200,000 German lemmings ready to march east in the service of McCain. He won't get anybody at the Brandenburg Gate. And in Africa, McCain has zero credibility when it comes time to saying, brothers, kick these Chinese out and turn back to U.S.-British imperialism with Obama's face on it. McCain simply can't do those things. When it comes to strike breaking and austerity enforcement on the home front, a garden variety reactionary like McCain can't do it. He has no credibility. He cannot, with any hope of being believed, invoke the ideology of global warming, the big lie, and the polar bears and the snail daughters and the horned owls, or solidarity with Africa. Still less can McCain do that. So McCain is altogether a weaker imperialist adversary. McCain is such a weak imperialist that it's going to be almost impossible to gin up these confrontations, because there will be no international support if McCain is the one offering these new policies or continuation of the old policies under, well, you get the idea. So that means that the most dangerous vote is the vote for Obama. It's a vote for social fascism and international confrontation. The other thing that's interesting about Biden's blurt out there in Seattle on the 19th of October is that he says the righteousness of the U.S. position will not be apparent. Remember, as I write in the German edition of Obama, the Postmodern Coup, which is doing very well, it's the number one book on Obama, the number one book on the U.S., the number one book on elections, and it's generally in the top five books on politics as a whole on the German Amazon.com version. As I write in there, the thing that Brzezinski is trying to do harkens back to the British elites. Remember, in my book, George Bush, The Unauthorized Biography. We have the story of Prescott Bush, the grandfather of the current tenant of the White House, helping to finance Hitler's seizure of power, supporting him with money, with weapons from those Connecticut arms manufacturers, quite formidable gun manufacturers up there in Connecticut in those days anyway. So the question is, what was that all about? Well, it was the attempt to build up the National Socialist regime in Germany to play Hitler against Stalin in the hope of getting rid of both of them so that the British Empire and its Wall Street junior partner at that point would be able to dominate the world for another century. Now, of course, in the process of building up the National Socialist alternative, the Continental Dagger for the British against Russia at that point, they had to sacrifice a lot of significant interests. The whole nation of Czechoslovakia was sacrificed. The whole Treaty of Versailles was sacrificed. France was massively sacrificed and betrayed by the British during the period of so-called appeasement. Again, appeasement is how you've heard about it, but that's a misnomer. It is a policy of active support for Hitler and playing Hitler against Stalin. Therefore, it's a war policy, not to try to get peace by making these appeasement offers. It is a desire to simply point Hitler east and put him into high gear and send him off to lose himself in the vastness of the steppes of Central Asia. That was the plan. It didn't work. No more will this plan work. The idea of using the smaller countries around Russia to cut off the oil, to cut off the natural gas, to try to play Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Poland, and Ukraine against Russia this winter, to try to play Ukraine against Russia over the issue of this Russian Black Sea fleet, to try to use Georgia for another round of attacks. You can imagine appeasement would be, for example, if the U.S. got to the point where China were up for grabs. You could imagine an Obama regime saying to the Chinese, look, we want you on our side against Russia. You want Taiwan, we'll give you Taiwan. Go and take it. But then point your armies into Siberia and put them on the march into Russian territory. All of these possibilities become eminently possible, but you can also see in the process why this is going to be very, very unpopular. How about a policy of arming Iran against Russia? That's one of the things that Brzezinski is clearly thinking of. That's what Biden was thinking of when he told the Israelis some weeks ago, listen, there's going to be a nuclear-armed Iran, and you Israelis had better get used to it, and don't you dare interfere with it, because that's what we want, we being Anglo-American imperialism, and we call the shots. So this is the nature of the problem. And again, I have to regard this with a kind of grim satisfaction. If you've been listening to this program during 2008, if you've seen these books, Obama, the Postmodern Coup, Barack H. Obama, The Unauthorized Biography, you'll see that this is my argument. Biden has now come forward. You have it straight from the horse's mouth. And later on, when you crawl out of the rubble that was your house in the thermonuclear exchange, or you're about to starve, or you're about to succumb to rickets, pellagra, scurvy, and other forms of malnutrition in a depression, remember, I told you so, and you've got to mobilize on this now. Act. 10 days remain. Do something to avoid the worst. We'll be back on World Crisis Radio. Radio for our second hour. In the first hour, we reviewed this amazing statement by Joe Biden in Seattle on the 19th of October, promising a 12-month perspective to a collapse of the Obama regime in the polls because of extremely unpopular economic measures in the midst of a systemic crisis. It means austerity beyond your wildest nightmares. That's the 12-month perspective. That assumes you live that long. Within the 6-month perspective, 4 to 5 scenarios of generated crisis featuring Russia above all, converging on some kind of an international confrontation, the U.S. position not evidently righteous to many people around the world. Is it a false flag? Is it backing a new aggression by a tin pot dictator like Saakashvili? Is it open appeasement, appeasement of Iran, appeasement of China? Hard to say, but some sweeping sellout of current allies in order to get the new allies that you can use against Russia and China. That's the kind of thing that we're talking about. So, again, I have to thank Biden for confirming the thesis of Obama the postmodern coup, the making of a Manchurian candidate, and Barack H. Obama, the unauthorized biography. Please get those at Amazon.com. This general thesis of Biden is not just confirmed by him. It's confirmed by Colin Powell. Colin Powell, acting in the tradition of Field Marshal von Hindenburg. Remember, von Hindenburg had a ne'er-do-well son, Oscar von Hindenburg, who had gambling debts, who was guilty of embezzlement, could have been indicted. The Nazis found out about this. They pulled the chain on von Hindenburg, and at that point, von Hindenburg dropped his longstanding opposition to making Hitler the chancellor and rolled over and named him chancellor, died soon after, to keep his ne'er-do-well, wastrel, bungling son, Oscar, out of the clink. And Colin Powell, I think his motivation is not, I don't think it's for a job for himself. I don't think it's racial. He doesn't care about that stuff. He cares about his ne'er-do-well son, Michael Powell, who made a mess of the Federal Communications Commission, clashed with Howard Stern, telling him that he was just a nepotist. He was there because of his famous father. I think Michael Powell is hurting, even though he's on the board of the Rand Corporation. That doesn't pay enough. So Mike, they got to take care of Michael Powell for another decade. That's what Colin Powell is doing. This is the kind of sleazy stuff that goes on among our oligarchs. There's an essay on that of mine, which you can find at actindependent.org and other sites. It's up at Rents and some other places. So Powell says there's going to be a crisis on the 21st, 22nd of January. I think he just means in the early days, but that's, I think, coherent. And Madeleine Albright, who says that it's just a statement of fact that Barkey will be tested. So the ruling class that we have, this gang of incompetent bunglers, a miserable excuse for a ruling class that we have, these financiers and their political operatives and running dogs, this is what they are planning to dish up. And remember, with Obama, they do it from a position of relative strength, and with McCain, they do it from a position of overwhelming weakness. So which one do you want to have to be fighting against? Because fight them you will have to if you want to defend your family's lives and your own standard of living. Now, this election is far from over. The polls are largely fake. We've been talking about that. That's one of the main ideas of Obama, the postmodern coup. These are fake polls. They're generated to assist in the postmodern coup. Some of it is simply the cooking of numbers by intelligence networks inside the polling organizations. That's the most obvious. Then there's also this other qualitative question. Remember, the Puma Democrats, the Hillary Clinton Democrats, the Reagan Democrats, the blue-collar Democrats of the Appalachian area, the area around the Great Lakes, heavily ethnic, heavily Catholic, socially conservative, but interested in New Deal economic programs, in other words, the opposite of Obama. And you'll remember that the polls back in June to July showed that it was about one-fifth to one-quarter of the Clinton voters who would not vote for Obama under any circumstances. And in the meantime, you've got people like Harriet Christian and Paula Abels of the RealDemocratsUSA.com. You've got the groups that you can trace at the Just Say No Deal website, a whole array of 100 to 150 websites. You can look at The Confluence with the famous River Daughter writing over there. These are all people who are not going to vote for Obama under any circumstances. And the big question is, has the existence of the Reagan Democrats, Puma Democrats, Clinton Democrats been systematically taken into account by the pollsters? And the Of course, the answer to that is overwhelmingly no, as far as we can see, because from the point of view of these Kool-Aid-drinking ideologues with thrills traveling up their legs for barkey, these people are not supposed to exist. So the potential is there for a stunning reverse on the day of the election, something similar, as we've pointed out, to the French, non, to the monstrous oligarchical European constitution, which was supposed to be rammed down the throats of the French people back in May of 2005. In other words, this novelty, this oligarchy, this elitism, this open rule by financiers, bankers, and parasites, in other words, the Obama campaign, that people may simply say no to that. They may have too much. They may identify with Joe the Plumber. They may not like Congressman Murtha has been spending too much time in the Pelosi clique. He's saying that his own constituents are racist and rednecks because they don't like Obama. This is absolutely absurd. You're getting an idea of how it felt to be a German under the rule of collective guilt after World War One, and the even worse collective guilt after World War II. We're getting into the area of somehow America has collective guilt. Barkey will be trading on that one, right? Because of imperialism, racism, slavery, and all the rest, there's collective guilt. Well, the word from this program is there is no such thing as collective guilt. It does not exist. People are responsible for their own actions. They're not responsible for the actions of others. So take that, Father Flager. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. And God knows what else he's got in there to smoke. So this is the situation. The polls are fake. And we've also got now the emergence, and we hope to have more about this, but we can't tell because our usual guest, Phil Berg, who's been giving a weekly report on this program since the end of August, is so much in demand. He's such a star that we're not sure we can get him today. But we do know the following, that the question of Obama, is he a natural-born citizen? First of all, is he natural-born? Was he born in Hawaii or, more likely, in Kenya, in Mombasa? And is he still a citizen? Didn't he give up his citizenship when he was naturalized, acknowledged, or adopted by Lolo Sotero in Indonesia back in the 1960s under the U.S. legislation that existed at that time? We know that there's a many-pronged attack coming. Phil Berg is getting more and more publicity. Jerome Corsi of the WorldNet Daily is now in Hawaii. And Andy Martin, the author of Obama, the Man Behind the Mask, the Chicago approach, right, the Chicago machine politics background of Obama, all of them converging on the idea that Obama is not qualified for the presidency. Leading edge of it is Phil Berg. He was mentioned by Savage on Wednesday evening, and then last night, Thursday night, that would be the 23rd of October, 1.5 hours for Phil Berg, apparently one of the longest guest appearances of anybody on the Savage program. This is the number 3 ranked radio talk show in the United States. It's something like 450 to 500 stations. So that particular genie is out of the bottle. Limbaugh yesterday, Thursday the 23rd, also talked about the Phil Berg case against Obama. This has got to explode now in the next 10 days. We'll be back in a minute.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Washington, D.C., Phil Berg appearing on the Michael Savage radio program yesterday evening, Thursday the 23rd of October. This was one of the longest interviews with many call-ins, most of them quite favorable. And out of this emerges news, which you can see at World Net Daily. Gold is where you find it these days. The ideological fronts are all in flux. So everybody is turning into their opposite sometimes more than once a day. What you see at the World Net Daily is that, according to Phil Berg, he's got a statement and affidavits to back it up from the paternal, this is the Obama side, this is Barack Hussein Obama Sr. of Kenya, the drunken lecher, just to make it clear, the polygamist, the serial polygamist, father of Obama, but father biologically, but never psychologically. This testimony is that the paternal grandmother of Obama on the Kenyan side said that she was present in the delivery room, presumably in Kenya, perhaps in the city of Mombasa, for the birth of Barky Obama. So that would put him outside and beyond the pale. The other side of it, of course, is the school certificate we have says Barry Sotero, nationality, Indonesian, religion, Islam. So that means he had been acknowledged or adopted by Lolo Sotero, lost his citizenship. So not natural born, doesn't have citizenship. Everybody who's so in such a blather about illegal aliens, well, here is an illegal alien you really do want to go after. You don't want to have an illegal alien elected president of the United States. And unless you do something, that is the picture that we're going into. So there's plenty of time to turn this around. But the other interesting thing, the question of the lost years at Columbia University, right? As I pointed out, I think I was one of the first to point out that between 1981 and 1983, there's this empty space in Obama's resume, and he won't tell you anything about it. He won't let Columbia University tell you. He won't tell you his grades, his friends, his transcripts, his professors, nothing. And we also know from Wayne Allen Root, the libertarian candidate for vice president, that even people who were at Columbia College in those years, graduated the same year in the same department, nobody has ever heard of this guy Obama. The alumni office doesn't know the reunions. He's never been to them. A politician would, of course, go to those reunions to network there. That's the whole nature of the game. So my explanation of that, the political one, I guess you might say, the sort of the world historical one, is that this is when he was recruited by Zbigniew Brzezinski, and that means that the trilateral Bilderberg Rand Corporation clique has been fostering and guiding his career. This is why he was brought together with somebody like Bill Ayers. Now, that would be the second one. Since Bill Ayers and Bernardine Dorn were living, at least part of that time, in the Morningside Heights, Upper Manhattan area near Columbia University, quite possible that either before, during, or after the recruitment by Zbigniew Brzezinski, that Obama was in close touch with Ayers and Dorn. I think I think Bill Ayers is Obama's best friend. And I think Bill Ayers and Bernardine Dorn are probably the people personally closest to him. Weathermen, terrorists, killers, bombers, members of a conspiracy that ended up killing cops and security guards. That is the Brinks affair in New York in the early 1980s. The reason why Bernardine Dorn refused to testify was that to protect her comrades or to protect herself from possible implication in a murder conspiracy. Cops and security guards killed in that Brinks robbery. And I've said it before, these are people who might have found themselves sitting in the electric chair or the gas chamber, depending on where they did their sprees, if it hadn't been for the fact that Bill Ayers and Bernardine Dorn are agents. They are protected assets of the U.S. intelligence community, and therefore they got off, and they've been rewarded with tenured professorships. And Bill Ayers controls $50 million of Annenberg Foundation money, and Bernardine Dorn gets tens of millions of dollars from the MacArthur Foundation. Why? Because they were foundation operatives the whole time, starting about 1965 or 66, wreckers sent in to destroy the student movement and the peace movement. So so far on the Colombia side, it may be that that's when Obama was recruited by Brzezinski. It may be that that is when he came into contact with Ayers and Dorn. Phil Berg's version is that he was a foreign student, that Obama was getting scholarships as a foreign student, someone who was a student from Indonesia, and therefore that would have been reflected on his transcript, and this is why those records are sealed. There's also the supermarket tabloid version, which is that he was engaging in a homosexual flamboyant lifestyle at that point. This has been on various blogs, at least, and postings on the Internet. So take your choice on the four: foreign student in cahoots with Bill Ayers, recruited by Brzezinski, or flamboyant gay lifestyle, which is now an embarrassment to him. Now, in terms of when some of this stuff is going to break, I think thanks to the Savage appearance, the Limbaugh mentioning, and various things, you've got to be vigilant now. The time for the big revelations, be it the Phil Berg accusation, be it the Larry Sinclair allegations, which are also very much in the forefront of people who are thinking of things to do in the last few days, the various 527s that we haven't really heard from enough. Some of these things could come as early as Tuesday or Wednesday, that is to say about a week before the November 4th election. However, historically, sometimes people wait until the very last moment. Two cases, 1992, the Weinberger indictment, which was a signal that the ruling elite did not want George Bush the Elder to be reelected. I believe that came on Thursday or Friday before the election. And the other one is the Bush DWI, intoxicated driving, drunk driving for George Bush, the current one, which did come on, I believe, the Friday before the vote. So we're going to get down to the wire. And the reason they have to do this is if you don't wait until the very last minute, then, of course, the mighty Wurlitzer goes into action and creates something else to distract the masses from this most recent revelation and the psychological truth contained in it. So if you've been waiting for the Michelle Obama hate Whitey tape, if you've been waiting for tapes involving Obama and various world religions, these may indeed be coming in the very last days. So don't give up the ship. Instead, do everything you can to keep this character out of the White House. We'll be back in a minute.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Well, search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Also mention here on World Crisis Radio, Laurie Dobson in Maine running a statewide write-in campaign after she was thrown off the ballot in an outrageous exercise of dirty machine politics by the Democratic Party, in particular up in Maine. So there's another candidate. You've got Kevin Barrett if you're in that area of La Crosse, Wisconsin, and Eau Claire, and in the entire state of Maine, I believe you can write in the name of Laurie Dobson, one of the signers of the Kenny Bunkport warning of late August 2007, which helped to head off the last gasp, in retrospect, of the Bush-Cheney neocon hardcore faction, their lunge towards Iran, which did not take place, in part thanks to the, or was not completed, thanks to the Kenny Bunkport warning. Now let's look at the financial markets, and having done as much as we can on the political front, the crash, of course, is getting worse and worse. This morning, that is to say, the morning of Friday, the 24th of October, the futures of the various stock indices here in the United States had gone down so far that trading was halted in those stock indices. A very interesting question is now whether we're going to head towards the circuit breakers and the trading halt. Let's just go through what this is so people know. After the crash of 1987, various things were set up. They're periodically adjusted. I'm going to give you what I believe to be the most recent version, that is the currently valid version of these circuit breakers. If the Dow Jones Industrial Average goes down, I think it's the Dow Jones. It could be the New York Stock Exchange average overall, but I think it's the Dow Jones. If it goes down 10% before 2 o'clock in the afternoon, there is a one-hour trading halt. If it goes down 10% between 2 and 2:30 p.m., there's a 30-minute halt. And if it goes down that much after 2:30 in the afternoon, there's no halt. You have to hang tough until 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Now, if it's a 20% decline in the stock market, if that happens before 1 p.m., there's a two-hour trading halt. If it happens between 1 and 2 in the afternoon, there's a one-hour halt. And if it goes down 20% after 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they pick up their dollies and go home because the market will then be closed for the day. So we may be getting close to that right now. I underestimated the fall in oil. Oil is now down to 63.64. And again, that's because hedge funds are going bankrupt. So get rid of hedge funds and you'll be paying a reasonable price for gasoline. Speculation is bad. And don't let any right-wing radio commentator tell you anything different. And Goldman Sachs was big, but the hedge funds are trying to carry the ball even as they approach bankruptcy. Now, this has been a horrendous day in the markets. This is a sort of pre-Halloween crisis. I guess we're 1 week before Halloween. The Japanese market is down 10%. That day is finished. The Hang Seng in Hong Kong down 8.3%. Singapore down 8.3%. Bombay down 11%. Jakarta down 7%. Korea down almost 11%. And the British touched a low of about 8.5% down. Germany was down 9.3%. The CAC 40 of Paris down 8.6%. And you've got the VIX reaching almost 90 points. That is to say, the volatility index, the fear index, reached 90% this morning. So this was already a very, very grim day. A lot of people, once again, attributing this to the fact that one or more large hedge funds is about to blow, and they are selling stocks, they're selling everything they've got, flailing desperately to avoid bankruptcy. Again, we don't need hedge funds. Outlaw hedge funds. We don't know which one is going bankrupt because they don't have to report anything. They can do anything they want. Chrysler, meaning Cerberus, meaning John Snow, former Secretary of the Treasury under the Bush regime, says that one quarter of all their white-collar workforce, it's 4,000 to 5,000 jobs, destroyed, especially in the formerly industrial Middle West. We're told that 750,000 jobs have been destroyed during 2008 so far, and it is expected that the job losses will head soon towards 2 million jobs lost. Unemployment will shortly be at 8%. Notice also this parade of countries going to grovel at the International Monetary Fund. So far, Belarus, Pakistan, Serbia, Hungary, Turkey, Ukraine, and of course Iceland is in very bad shape. Not clear what they will do. This is the supranational regime. This is the finance oligarchs imposing their rule, not through a government, but through the International Monetary Fund. And that's the one to look for, because that's what's growing empirically out of the present crisis. Interestingly, OPEC said today in Vienna that they were going to cut oil production, but that doesn't have any effect on the price, because the price is not determined by a market in the sense that the ideologues would have you think. It's determined by hedge fund speculation. Now, This is obviously a disaster, and no normal person should continue to have money in such a market, right? You've got to diversify out of paper, diversify out of dollar-denominated paper. Obviously, gold is a good thing to hedge in, but then there's also owning your own home free and clear with no mortgage, no mortgage broker, no bank, no derivatives involved, owning a car, owning the tools of your trade, having a well-stocked pantry, obviously a good idea, and of course, investment in education, always a good idea, something that the economic crisis cannot destroy. Now, we've also got the question of the bailout measures, question of the new Bretton Woods, since that's what it's going to be called. This, I think, is a real sham. We've got an attempt by Obama and his acolytes to try to present the bailout as something that Franklin D. Roosevelt and the New Dealers would like. This is obviously a big lie. And to call this thing that's coming up a new Bretton Woods, I think, is a sham, a bogus sham, and a cruel hoax. I call it Basel III. In other words, it's going to be the new Bretton Woods of toxic derivatives. That seems to be what they're going to talk about. It's a new rogue state summit for derivatives. It's not going to be in the great tradition of Bretton Woods. It's going to be in the reactionary tradition of the Congress of Vienna and the Peace of Paris, especially Versailles and Trianon and Neuilly and Sèvres and these monstrosities. So what are they going to do? It is true that Sarkozy, to give himself some cover, I think, vis-a-vis the French bureaucracy, has said that what should come out of this is a system of fixed parities. I think that's not gonna be effective. That's not gonna be what it is. I think what they're gonna focus on are measures to prop up speculative, fictitious, bloated, cancerous paper values, featuring, of course, the derivatives, the structured investment vehicles, the collateralized debt obligations, the mortgage-backed securities, and the other monstrous innovations that have come forward. It's interesting to see that Alan Greenspan this week in the Waxman Committee was partially nailed for his role. In other words, you'll remember that Greenspan, all during the 90s, was indignant whenever there was any attempt to regulate derivatives. No, no, horrors, said Greenspan. Any attempt to even make them reportable, Greenspan blocked all that. So he's obviously one of the main architects of this crisis. And he's not a banker not a central banker. He's a Wall Street puppet. Back in a minute.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
The November 4th election, remember three things: stop Obama, punish any elected official who voted for this monstrous and futile bailout, and come out of it with divided government, no one-party state. We don't want the fascist dictatorship of the repo clique, being Reid, Pelosi, and Obama. We do not want them. Nick's government of the repo clique. So those are the recommendations here. Now, concerning this Chimera Bretton Woods, remember the Basel meetings were attempts to establish accounting standards and the complete failure also to limit leverage and to prevent the cooking of the books. Complete failure. This will be Basel III. It will be a summit for the prevention of, for the protection of toxic derivatives and derivatives in general. And I think the chances are it's going to be a failure. It will be like this conference that the British, you'll recall, cooked up in the spring of 1933. They wanted to try to shift the unwinding burden of the Depression onto other countries, and they tried to entice Franklin D. Roosevelt to come to a conference where the British would be calling the shots and the U.S. would be placed under tremendous international pressure to essentially sacrifice everything for the sake of London. And Roosevelt quite correctly said, no, I am not going to do that. There was an attempt after that to blame Roosevelt for the further unwinding of the Depression. This was absolutely fantastic, manufactured by British propaganda. I think this Sarkozy meeting is going to be that. Anyway, it's on November 15th, and I can see that some of the usual suspects are running around saying that it's going to be the new Bretton Woods. Yeah, the new Bretton Woods under the leadership of Gordon Brown. Notice that the Gordon Brown British operation has essentially seized leadership over the financial policies of the world. In other words, the most backward economic area is now dictating to places like Germany, Japan, the Asian tigers, and even to the United States. So this is a sad, sad situation. I don't think too much is going to come out of it, but rather we are going to see the Depression getting significantly worse. Now let's look at the domestic outcome of this stuff. Remember that everything done so far is more or less within the bounds of the Herbert Hoover Reconstruction Finance Corporation. Remember, this was an entity created in 1931 with a capitalization equal approximately a little bit less than the yearly budget of the U.S. federal government. So that's sort of where we are, maybe, you know, roughly, very rough. At least we're within one order of magnitude of that, and I guess that's what counts. Now, the news today is that PNC Bank is buying National City, National City being not the old bank in the became Citibank, but a newer regional bank. So PNC is buying National City to prevent that one from blowing up. They're paying $5.6 billion to take over National City. But in the meantime, they are getting a $7.7 billion cash infusion from, and I hate to say this, the TARP, that is to say the Troubled Assets Relief Program. I would call it the Toxic Assets Refinancing Program. And every time I hear this word, I feel personally insulted. So this is what they now call the TARP. But notice, the PNC Bank has been admitted to the state-sponsored compulsory cartel, that is to say the fascist corporate state, of approved banks who get money from the federal government to buy up other banks. And all of this is typical Reconstruction Finance Corporation stuff. Herbert Hoover, 1931, 1932, into 1933, using the Reconstruction Finance Corporation as a desperate instrument to save banks that are going bankrupt, to prop up bloated speculative values. In those days, it was a mass of kited international bills. Today, it's a mass of kited derivatives in the neighborhood of $1 quadrillion or more. And it won't work. The Reconstruction Finance Corporation, with all of its money, $2.5 billion, which at that time was, again, about three-quarters or four-fifths of the budget of the entire federal government, a great deal of money for those days, was unable to prevent any bank from shutting down, because all banks shut down on the night before the inauguration of Franklin D. Roosevelt. So Herbert Hoover struck out completely with the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, and that is what we're doing now in an uncanny Nietzschean repetition of the same thing. Wiederkehr des Gleichen, I guess Nietzsche would say, that old fascist. We're seeing this uncanny repetition. As Marx would say, they don't know it, but they do it. They don't know what they're recapitulating, but recapitulate is what they do. They replicate all of the idiocy of Herbert Hoover. So this stuff is going to get nowhere. Attempts to prop up speculative values in the midst of a panic are doomed, and attempts to maintain the solvency of banks in that process are also doomed. The only thing to do is the New Deal approach, and that simply means wipe out derivatives, shred them, delete them, get rid of them. Don't try to prop them up. Don't spend a penny. Don't spend a nickel on the mass of kited derivatives amounting to $1 quadrillion. Get rid of them. Same thing with hedge funds. Hedge funds destroying your economy? Easy. Outlaw them. Force them to report everything and slap a tax on any hedge fund that speculates in the petroleum markets. And above all, we've got to get ready for Chapter 11 for the entire thing, because we're going to have debt moratorium on all international financial debt, freeze all financial debt. We're going to have a ban on foreclosures inside the U.S., make it a federal crime to foreclose on homes, farms, businesses, infrastructures, things like airlines, ferries, railroads, trucking companies, cab companies, and we're going to have to seize the whole Federal Reserve if we can, but if we can't seize the whole thing, seize at least part of it and turn that into the Main Street lending window. $1 trillion available and interest rates varying from 0.5% to 1% to reflate the economy, to reflate this collapsed banking system. You want to get lending going again? Don't look at LIBOR. Look at seizing the Fed, opening up the Main Street window, and mandating cheap credit for productive purposes only, for farming, for mining, for manufacturing, for hard commodity production, for the creation of tangible physical goods, for commerce, for moving goods from one place to another, but not for financial services, drug money laundering, gambling, prostitution, and the other array of activities that are getting preferential treatment under the current situation. In other words, the preservation of human civilization through commodity production has to be in first place. And rather than letting these layoffs go forward, we got layoffs at Xerox, Chrysler, Yahoo, General Motors, and so forth. Anything that's productive in there, and that would be all of them except maybe Yahoo. And even there, there's some selling that goes on. There's some commerce that's involved in the real world, electronics and other things. If these companies, if the management of Chrysler in particular, this gang of hedge fund hyenas from Cerberus, if they're going to cut one-fourth of the white-collar jobs, maybe it's time to nationalize Chrysler and save them, to save those production lines. So remember, Obama, the postmodern coup, the making of a Manchurian candidate, get it at Amazon.com. Barack H. Obama, the unauthorized biography. Get that one at Amazon.com. And remember, we have a fascist coup in progress here. Time to get active or get radioactive. Time to become politically energized. Don't be dismayed by fake polling. Get out there. Defeat Obama. Punish the people who brought you the bailout. And get divided government and gridlock out of this whole thing. We'll see you next week.